This is tape one, side A, Senate Committee on Governmental Activities. This is April the 20th, 1981. We're in hearing room A of the State Capitol Building. Items on the agenda this evening are Senate Joint Memorial 11, Senate Bills 127, 134, 903, and 904, with a work session on Senate Joint Resolution 30, possible work session on Senate Bill 183.
Agenda is Senate Joint Memorial 11, which memorializes Congress to adopt legislation conferring status of veterans on certain civilians. And Senator Hannon, would you like to come forward? And do you have some people that you want to bring up with you? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Len Hannon, State Senator, District 26, and this evening I have two constituents from Jackson County, Mr. Donald Rounds and Dr. Jim Dorder. We are here to testify on behalf of Senate Joint Memorial 11, and the reason for this legislation is that instead of introducing legislation here only affecting the state of Oregon, we felt it was more appropriate that we take this approach to memorialize Congress to enact legislation conferring this veteran status upon those civilians that were interned during World War II. I'm not going to speak any longer on this, but I'd like to have both these gentlemen share the story of their experience, and then, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee would be happy to respond to some questions.
Thank you. My name is Jim Dorder, and I'd like to start off by saying originally this was a very personal thing with me, and now it's gone beyond that into this joint Memorial 11. But I would like to say that I think Oregon has a very humane program for veterans, particularly in the housing program. And I was getting ready to use this program, having been a veteran. And my service was very cursory. It was very short. It wasn't very dramatic. It wasn't traumatic in any way. And then I began to realize that my longtime friend, Don Rounds, has been a 24-year citizen in the state of Oregon, professional person. And I realized that, in contrast to my background, he had been captured in the very earliest days of World War II, spent the entire World War II in the South Tomas prison in the Philippines. His parents managed to get up into the mountains and were part of the resistance movement, and late in the war they were captured and killed. And it began to dawn on me that perhaps I should try and make some attempt to find a way to see if his service was not indeed at least the equivalent of many of the very strange and sundry jobs that you can have in the various services. My enlistment, for instance, was only for 18 months, and yet Don spent the entire war in a Japanese prison camp. So I want to thank Senator Hannon and those joint legislators who are sponsoring this memorial, and I would like to now pass on to Don Rounds, who I think will give you a better, more formal statement of his position.
Thank you, Mr. Rounds.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to read a prepared statement that I have that might address itself to Senate Joint Memorial 11. To elucidate some of the factors that we feel that this is a just bill. I'm testifying on behalf of myself and other Oregon civilians interned in camps by the Japanese in the Philippines during World War II. I'm urging you to adopt Senate Joint Memorial 11. The bill would be applicable to the following numbers of ex-internees. In Oregon, there are some 13 persons we were able to verify. There are probably at least a dozen more in the state. Of those verified, four from Portland, three from Roseburg, two from Eugene, and one each from Staten, Rogue River, Gold Hill, and Ashland. Nationwide, from a February 1945 count of 6,399 internees, we estimate that there are about 3,000, 4,000 survivors. As this group is probably the largest internee group, the addition of internees from other theaters and wars would still constitute a small number, which would in turn result in a small economic impact by the adoption of this measure. The physical, emotional, and social stresses and deprivations suffered by internees do equate with combat experience. Although each internee had individually unique experiences, most of us have suffered through bombing and strafing, 3 years of imprisonment, combat action and artillery shelling, starvation and disease, brutality and humiliation, slave labor, loss of possessions, livelihoods, and fortunes, and executions. At the time of liberation, we were dying off at the rate of 5 per day from malnutrition. We suffered a little over 400 deaths from the above-mentioned causes. Although our ambassadorial staff was repatriated, we were left behind and consequently used as hostages. The rescue of Santo Tomas and Los Baños camps were speeded up due to intelligence reports that disclosed the Japanese were going to kill the men 18 and over and use women and children as hostages. As it was, we were rescued a day before the plan was to take effect. During the rescue, 100 or so of the San Tomas internees were taken hostages by the Japanese garrison to effect their return to their lines. The tense standoff of this situation was alleviated by brave negotiating by our camp interpreter. Although we were non-combatants, we did serve our nation by keeping the faith, and that our presence reminded the Filipinos that the USA was still around and planned to return. We did have guerrilla leader in San Tomas who directed activities from the camp through a hidden radio. We also served as a reminder to the Filipinos that despite the Japanese propaganda that democracy did not work, our camps were living proof that indeed democracy works very well, being self-governed with constitutions, rights, and elections. These camps demonstrated the resourcefulness, resiliency, and depth of character and talent that Americans can show in times of stress and crisis. Demonstrated was our genius for organizational appropriateness, technological ingenuity, negotiating skill, and our humane penchant for social equality. It was a performance that I'm still proud to have been a small part of. After our liberation and return to the U.S., we had to adjust to a familiar yet new society to us. We had been out of circulation for years, our educations interrupted, businesses, careers, and fortunes demolished. Middle-aged and older internees found assimilation back into the economy difficult. They were either too old, overqualified, not up to the state of the art, or with no collateral. Our efforts to redress these conditions resulted in a minuscule Japanese Reparations Act, which consisted of $1 a day for adults and 50 cents for children and a token amount for businesses. Otherwise, our efforts fell on deaf ears. Of late, there has been a renewed interest in ex-prisoners. A national organization of primarily military personnel called American Ex-Prisoners of War Incorporated have recognized us civilians for membership now and have succeeded in getting civilian employees of the Defense Department who served in combat areas as veterans, as well as telephone operators of World War I and women ferry pilots of World War II. It should be pointed out here also that General MacArthur awarded civilian internees battle ribbons as those worn, the same as those worn by the armed services, and that the Japanese always referred to us as prisoners of war. In summary, the adoption of Senate Joint Memorial 11 appears to be equitable and in the public interest. It would confer upon civilian internees benefits found appropriate to veterans of federal and state veterans by federal and state governments. I thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, question. Yes.
Are you ready for a motion to send this to the floor? I would
submit. Could I ask a question?
Yes.
This is irrelevant to move it out. I'm, in a sense, regretful that you testify because it reawakens my intense interest in the Japanese. But in any event, the question is, during the time that their plan to kill the men 18 and over and use the women and children as hostages was disclosed, what year and approximate month was that?
It was about February of 45. We were rescued February 3rd, and I think it was planned that on the 4th, that in Santo Tomas, this was to happen.
The camp commander? This was a camp commander's discretionary order, to your knowledge, or do you
know? To my knowledge, I don't really know.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question. All right, it's been moved that we send Senate Joint Memorial 11 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Being none, would you please call the roll?
Senator Day?
Aye.
Senator Gardner?
Aye.
Senator Meeker? Senator Powell? Senator Thorne? Senator Halleck?
Aye.
Senator Ripper?
Aye. Motion is carried. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
What's the next one?
We're going to take 903 and 904 because some of the staff have to leave. The 903, we have Ken Otto.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ken Otto, and I'm Assistant Administrator of the Legislative Administration
Committee. Anything you want, you got, kid.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know about that, babe.
The Legislative Supplies account was established in 1969 as a revolving account to deal with Legislative Assembly supplies and equipment purchases and sales. Supplies and equipment would be purchased from the account, and the account would be replenished when the equipment and supplies were sold. The theory and the practice never really met. The account was never a true revolving account. Each legislative assembly subsidized it with a large general fund appropriation. Only typewriters and some equipment were purchased from legislative supplies funds. Other supplies and equipment were purchased with the general fund appropriation. This split bookkeeping system made it difficult to get a true picture of legislative supply and capital outlay expenditures. To get a more accurate picture, a cost center entitled Legislative Supplies was established within the Legislative Assembly Miscellaneous Receipts account. Receipts from the sale of equipment and supplies were deposited in the Miscellaneous Receipts account instead of the supplies account, and in turn credited to the cost center. Equipment and supplies were purchased from the receipts in the general fund appropriation. The legislative supplies account was bypassed. In his last audit report of the Legislative Assembly, the state auditor criticized this practice as not technically complying with the law. However, we feel it does comply with accepted accounting practices. To further complicate matters, the 1979 legislature changed the practice of purchasing legislative equipment and supplies. In effect, now, equipment and supplies are initially purchased by the Legislative Administration Committee and then sold to the Legislative Assembly. Again, the supplies account is not used. This practice meets accounting and other legal requirements. Senate Bill 903 abolishes the legislative supplies account and reverts its balance, currently approximately $55,000, to the general fund. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Ken. Questions?
Want to move the bill?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Let's do it.
All right, then it's been moved that Senate Bill 903, which sure will allow about $55,000 to get back into the general fund, be approved and sent to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion?
Go ahead.
I can't say, is there any objection? If not, quite the right meeting. The clerk, please call the roll.
Senator Day?
Aye.
Senator Gardner?
Aye.
Senator Meeker? Senator Powell? Senator Thorne? Senator Halleck?
Aye.
Senator Ripper?
Aye. All right, motion is carried.
Thank you.
Now we'll go to 904 and have Marv Sherman. And then after Marv, we'll hear from Betsy Belshaw, the state court administrator.
Have we had a hearing on this bill once?
Or was it the parking lot?
What was it?
Dealt with the parking.
Yeah.
It was just the parking lot.
And she mentioned that this was coming up right at the time.
Yeah. Betsy, do you want to come up too, as long as we're... both of you write together, and you're both going to say the same things, practically, so.
I'm ready to move this one out. I really don't.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Marv Sherman. I'm Director of Administrative Services for Legislative Administration Committee. I'm here to introduce Senate Bill 904, which transfers the responsibility of the Supreme Court building from Legislative Administration to the Supreme Court. Just a bit of background, the 1977 legislature enacted the legislation to fund the construction of the Capitol wings and pay off the indebtedness of several other state buildings, including the Capitol and the Supreme Court building.
and the responsibility for the government offices that were not part of the executive branch were transferred to legislative branch, including the Capitol and the Supreme Court building. The Supreme Court has always been maintained by the Department of General Services. This includes all the custodial support, building maintenance, and security. When the statutory change of ownership occurred, we negotiated with the state court administrator to continue to carry on the daily supervision of the building with maintenance support from the Department of General Services. And the important thing here is that all payments for this support are made direct from the Supreme Court budget to the General Services by direction of the Ways and Means Committee. The rub is that the auditors believe that this arrangement is improper and suggest that Legislative Administration Committee contract with the Department of General Services for maintenance of the Supreme Court building, and the Supreme Court then reimburse Legislative Administration. This three-way transaction seems unnecessarily ponderous. The proposed legislation would remove the Supreme Court building from the Legislative Administration Committee's jurisdiction and would enable the Supreme Court to contract directly with the Department of General Services for maintenance of the building. The Senate agreed with this idea by passing an identical bill during the last days of the 1979 session. Unfortunately, the House was not able to act on the bill before adjournment. The Supreme Court has suggested several minor amendments to the bill for better clarification. I think that you have those before you, and I'll give a copy here to the administrator. They have been reviewed by legislative counsel, and we have no objection to the suggested changes, and we recommend that they be incorporated into this bill. The benefits to the Assembly is that it relieves legislative administration of the responsibility for establishing and maintaining the accounting records in order to conform to audit requirements, and it eliminates the necessity for legislative administration management of judicial branch business.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
sir. I move the amendment stated 41681 to Senate Bill 904.
All right, thank you. The is there any objection to the amendments? All right, there no objection. They're accepted. Betsy, would you like to... are you finished?
I'm finished.
Yeah, Betsy?
I have nothing to add to that other than what I told you when I was here before. We'd like this resolved. At that time, you mentioned some hesitancy about turning the building over to the Supreme Court, that you, some of you, think felt that it should be under the responsibility of the General Services Administration. We have no problem with that, whichever way you would prefer to go, but we would like it resolved one way or the other so that we can deal with the problems we have with the building in a more efficient manner than we do now.
Sure. Yes. Mm-hmm. Deletion of lines 9 through 11. Surplusage?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Okay. No objection.
Chairman?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 904 as amended to the floor of the report.
All right, is there any further discussion? If not, then Senator Day moves that we send Senate Bill 904 as amended to the floor of the Senate with the pass recommendation. Those in favor, will answer aye. Would you please call their names, please?
Senator Day?
Aye.
Senator Gardner?
Aye.
Senator Meeker? Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator?
Excuse me.
Thorn? Senator Halleck?
Aye.
Senator Ripper?
Aye. Motion is carried.
Thank you.
And we're really in the mood to do this background here today.
Well, I think when you were here on the parking lot, Betsy, you completely convinced us that we didn't want to argue with you.
We had tried not to. Okay.
Read the circle plan. Just the circle plan.
127 and 134. Daryl, which one do you want to take first? 130?
Precisely.
134, perhaps. 134, okay. Take 134. Is there any objection to taking this off the table? So,
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Daryl Rawls, Director of the Department of General Services. I would like to say that this is a simple housekeeping bill, but the fact of the matter, it is not. It is probably one of the most complicated bills that at least the General Services has presented to the Assembly. It started out principally to deal with the issues of confusion in existing statutes. Right now, ORS 271 covers a broad spectrum of public lands by a wide variety of state agencies and local government. And as state agencies go through the statutes and attempt to extract from those statutes what our responsibilities for public land management are, it is confusing and difficult, and we suspect we are not meeting the intent of the Assembly in carrying out those statutes. The principal reason, then, for Senate Bill 134 is to present the issue of separating state land management from local government land management and providing proper terms and definitions so that we may clearly understand who has what responsibility. If you did nothing more than deal with the issue of separating state from local government land management, this would be a milestone advancement for the state agencies who have to administer these statutes. So that's what we started out to do. There are, however, some other policy issues that we have introduced, and I will go quickly through them. Item 2, we are suggesting that leases in excess of 5 years be reviewed by the Department of General Services, principally to deal with the issue of sharing that might go on between state agencies. It would not be profitable for one agency to enter into a 99-year lease of land that might well be used by some other state agency. Thirdly, same principle with respect to ultimate disposition of public lands. We think General Services should review those from the standpoint of sharing resources between state agencies. We do suggest, however, that we exempt fish and wildlife lands, forest lands, right-of-way lands by the Department of Transportation and Division of State lands, which really are not the kind of lands that we would expect state agencies to want to share for general governmental purposes. Item 4, we have inserted some new definitions. These are technical only. State lands to be those controlled by the Division of State Lands, and public lands to be all other state-owned lands, again for clarification so we know what it is we're supposed to be doing. Item 5, we have suggested that the existing legislative review of General Services land sales be drawn down specifically to those in Salem, where we know there has been the most legislative interest in the past. Now, this is not a big item. We are not, it's not a major item to restrict legislative review. We're simply suggesting that the volume of activity probably does not merit the amount of legislative review currently required, and it might be more profitable to deal with the lands in Salem. 6, we would suggest we delete the obsolete references to Columbia Park Hospital, which is no longer state-owned. 7th, we think that the titling of state-owned lands should be in the state's name through an owning agency. Right now, you cannot go down to the county or city records and find out who owns what land. It is a nightmare, quite frankly, to figure out which agency is responsible. It's a headache for local government as well as for state government. 8, we believe that there is a need for the department to have some additional authority with respect to frequency of land appraisal. 9th, we do need some statutory authority for continuous appropriation of assessments that we are authorized to cover the maintenance of the properties that are entrusted to us. And 10th is a new issue. We are suggesting that the department have authority to gain title to surplus lands where it is with the consent of the state agency. Today we have authority only to gain title to lands that are derived from the old Board of Control, that is specifically the institutions of the Department of Human Resources. If other agencies who own lands decide to surplus it, we think it would be profitable for the state if General Services could gain title to that for sharing again among state needs. Now, as we went through this after it was drafted, it became apparent that it was a rather complex, confusing, major redraft of existing statutes. So we sent copies of the bill out to all state agencies that had any significant impact or interest in this bill and asked for comments back from them. We did get a variety of comments falling into two categories. One category were additional technical changes that were necessary to achieve the separation of the statutes as we started out to achieve. A second set of comments had to do with desirable things that state agencies asked us to do that went beyond the basic intent that we had in the bill. These desirable features we're not going to present to you tonight because we think the bill is already burdensome enough with the changes that we've proposed. We are suggesting attached to the amendments, or attached to my testimony, are some additional amendments that will deal with some of these questions raised by the state agencies. First, we would ask you to amend the bill to exempt from General Services review of long-term leases, the airspace leases by DOT, forest land leases, leases by higher education, legislative or judicial branches, Division of State Lands, and higher ed also with respect to terminal disposition of the land. Exempt that from General Services review.
What do you got left?
The other major agencies that own land for office purposes or essentially, we've exempted forest lands, fish and wildlife lands, except for higher ed. And their lands are probably, or their buildings are probably not all that shareable by other state agencies. It was a judgment call. We think the volume of activity also with respect to higher education is probably beyond our capability to do a decent job. And it'd probably be best that we not bite that biscuit off.
Leases, too?
Long-term leases, yes. Secondly, we do need to correct several contradictory references to real property appraisal. In some places, you have to have three appraisers. In other areas, you don't. We think there ought to be one uniform definition. Thirdly, we incorrectly left out a reference to Division of State Lands responsibilities, which would be disastrous if it were not reinserted back into this bill. We've harmonized the references to political subdivisions, and we would ask for authority for General Services to delegate its existing authority for sale notifications to other state agencies where they can do it easier or perhaps at less cost than we could. Item 6, House Bill 2037 has passed both houses with respect to a $5,000 limit for certain highway division sales, and there's a reference needed in this bill to harmonize it so we don't end up with the old references. Item 7, we need to reference in this legislation current ORS 283, which gives local jurisdictions the first right of refusal on surplus property after state agencies decide they don't need it. That needs to be put into Chapter 273. We have two printing errors on page 10 of the bill. And lastly, we would ask to be able to delegate our inventory responsibility, again, to state agencies where they can do it easier at less cost than we do. This attached to the bill is a rather complete analysis of the various sections that we are changing. And I guess it goes without saying that for you to thoroughly review all of the verbiage changes in this bill, it takes a person about 2 hours to walk through it. At least that's what it's taken me to walk through all of this. Rather complicated. Let me finalize by saying I don't believe there are any fiscal implications of any consequence in this bill. There are certainly none for the Department of General Services, and we've had no agency make any major objections to the bill other than these technical changes that they have asked us to make. The bill is important, if for no other reason than to separate state land management into one section, separate it from local jurisdiction land management. Each time a political subdivision comes into the legislature and asks for appropriate changes to their responsibilities, they change state processes as well and complicate it further. And we do the same to them as we try to change our statutes. Those two statutes need badly to be separated. These other issues that we've inserted, we don't believe they constitute major policy changes, but I do want you to clearly understand that there are about three or four practices that would be different under this bill than under current practice, and that is specifically we would review all long-term leases over 5 years. We would review all terminal leases except in the categories enumerated, such as higher ed, forest lands, fish and wildlife, and we would move to a uniform appraisal process. I think those are essentially the new practices that we would follow with this bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Why do we want to give up legislative review over the sale of land, other than in the urban growth boundaries?
Purely the volume of land sales that could potentially be involved. It is not a big issue with us. The legislature has not been keenly interested in this in the past, except in the Salem area. But as I say, it's not a major issue.
What land sales have we reviewed outside of the Salem area, except for that that's on the committee for sale of state lands?
Columbia Park is the only one that I know of.
The only other one, isn't it?
Quite frankly, there's a lot of land activity going on that, I doubt is going to the emergency board as required by the existing statutes.
Well, the hundreds of pieces that are bought and sold back and forth by the highway division, I don't think any...